Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Patrick Fort. CDOT aims to reopen I-70 in Glenwood Canyon this afternoon.
Officials say delays will continue for at least a month, even after the highway opens back up.
An 18-year-old triggered an hours-long standoff in Carbondale on Tuesday.
A wide range of comedians are descending on Aspen this weekend for the Laugh Festival.
A new THC-infused drink is now for sale in Aspen.
We talk with a custom guitar maker here in the Roaring Fork Valley.
And sit down with the top tourism chief for the state.
That's coming up on Mountain Edition.
CDOT says workers are doing everything they can to get I-70 ready for reopening today. I-70 east of Glenwood Springs has been closed since a major rockfall on Monday night. The agency is removing rocks above the closed section, and more rock is coming down than anticipated.
The area is 8 miles east of Glenwood Springs, just west of Hanging Lake. Even if I-70 is reopened today, some lanes will still be closed for continuing repair that's expected to last at least a month.
The town of Carbondale breathed a sigh of relief Tuesday after law enforcement resolved an hours-long standoff. 18-year-old Andres Carrillo de Lara triggered the incident and is being held on a $25,000 bond at the Garfield County Jail.
The defendant appeared in court Wednesday, where a judge expressed concern about the seriousness of the standoff between Carrillo de Lara and law enforcement, previous threats against the district attorney's office, and yet another incident. District Attorney Sherry Kaloya.
He is also being held on a warrant out of Eagle County with a bond for $10,000. Eagle County DAs and we will discuss whether we can do a resolution of his case there and the case here.
The Eagle County charges are for felony trespass and car theft. Andres Carrillo de Lara allegedly threatened family Tuesday with what is described as a black BB gun before retreating to a bedroom. He surrendered hours later after putting the entire town of Carbondale on high alert.
Occupancy numbers for January in Snowmass and Aspen came in just shy of last year's bookings. Both resorts filled about 70% of their lodge rooms. Carolyn Sakariasen has more.
Last-minute bookings are what saved January for both resorts, even though Aspen came in 2% behind last year and Snowmass 3%. According to Central Reservations Agency Stay Aspen Snowmass, those numbers are remarkable given how light Australian business was, along with the X Games being a week later than usual. For this month, occupancy was pacing slightly behind last year as of January 31st. Snowmass is struggling a bit with more than a nearly 8% deficit from 2015. Resort officials attribute a slower February because of a downturn in Brazilian business, and the first 3 weeks of March are also pacing behind last year. What has increased for Aspen lodges are their average daily rate, which is at $518 a night. Snowmass's average daily rate lost ground and is at $407, down $16 from last year. Carolyn Sakariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
Oil and gas companies are deciding how to respond to the BLM's expected decision about leases on the Thompson Divide.
The West Slope Colorado Oil and Gas Association is working with about 8 companies directly affected by a pending BLM decision. Association Director David Ludlum says his organization wasn't surprised when the BLM announced last week that officials are leaning towards canceling 25 oil and gas leases on the Thompson Divide and restricting about a dozen others.
While each company is going to probably experience varying degrees of damages, we think that there could be a way to go about this that would assess collective damage and make the process a little bit more efficient in terms of looking at our legal options.
Ludlum says it's too early to ballpark how much damages could add up to. His group believes a new natural gas well near the Thompson Divide indicates how valuable the leases are. Any legal action would have to wait until the final BLM decision is issued, which is expected to be this fall.
Major support for Aspen Public Radio's environmental reporting comes from the John Denver Aspen Glow Fund at the Aspen Community Foundation, promoting responsible stewardship of the lands and wilderness of Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley.
A new cannabis product available in Aspen is reflective of the exponential growth in the edible marijuana industry. Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bechtesh reports.
Part-time Aspen resident Tripp Kieber is CEO of Dixie Brands, an infused cannabis product company. That means THC-laced cookies, chocolates, gummies, you name it.
I was dubbed the Willy Wonka of weed, which my mother wasn't really pleased about.
And now Dixie Elixirs is distributing Quigley's, a 2-ounce liquid shot of pot. The two locations in Aspen that carry the product were among the first in the state to place it on their shelves. Makers of Quigley's boast that the THC consumed through the shot takes effect quickly, unlike other edibles whose delayed onset effects can result in overdosing. This is a breakthrough in an industry that has already seen multi-million dollar gains.
It was just reported 2 days ago, the state of Colorado sold over $996 million, just $4 million short of $1 billion. Of that, over 50%, $500 million in infused products was sold as compared to $5 million in 2010.
Tony Alfieri invented the pot shot when a friend wanted to use medical marijuana, but without the side effects of smoking pot.
Something you can take, you know, anytime, that you don't smell like you just, you know, medicated. You don't, your eyes don't turn red and you don't cough and those kind of things. It removes some of that stigma of smoking from a medical patient.
Really, Quigley's is quick and discreet for anyone who uses it. During the X Games, sample of the product were available for free at Boogie's. Kieber says the type of private pot club set up at the downtown establishment could become a new norm.
Literally, there were no issues, whether it be from police to the fire department to city council members, all came through the facility. It's incredibly exciting to see, and I think that might be the foundation for what more is to come. And we need to find a place where people can embrace marijuana responsibly, and most importantly, out of the reach, out of the eyesight of children.
Alfieri says we're a long way from someone being able to walk up to a bar and have their choice of a marijuana-infused drink or a bottle of beer. For one thing, he says, his pot shot is a one-and-done product and would not be profitable for bars compared to a customer's full night of drinking. And secondly, no bills in the state legislature this session would allow for bars to sell marijuana products. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. If you're a guitar or bass player, you've probably pined over the idea of having an instrument made just for you. It's an expensive, difficult, and time-consuming process. One business in the Valley is making custom guitars, but they're coming from the hands of someone much younger than you might think. Patrick has this story about how learning a craft can take you from Canada to one of the most respected concert venues in the world.
It's cleaning week in Miles Phillips' workshop. The scent of wood wafts through the air and sawdust floats through the room.
This, for me, is incredibly dirty.
There are small parts like tuning pegs and strings neatly organized, and a standing toolbox, which he calls his pride and joy, sitting neatly in the corner. It's the studio where Miles Phillips runs his custom guitar company.
I built my first instrument sophomore year of high school. It was in the Aspen Wood Tech room.
It was a 5-string bass. You can't go without that extra string, he says. He calls it the Prince bass. It has carved swirls that look like something Prince would have played. Then, in his senior year of high school, Phillips built 2 acoustic guitars. He calls one of them the Log. So, after graduating, he didn't want to go to college. He found an instrument building program in British Columbia. And now, at 23, Phillips makes about 20 instruments a year. Building instruments requires a solid musical ear. Especially with acoustic guitars, small adjustments to the pieces of wood can have huge impacts on the sound of the instrument. Phillips says he can tune a guitar by ear. In this test, he got within 10 cents of each pitch. Playing the guitar is therapeutic for Phillips. It helps him get back to center.
Music is clarity, and it's kind of the reset button. If I've been having a bad day, I love to go upstairs and wail on guitar and try and sound great for an hour and maybe sound good for 5 minutes, but it's a cleansing thing.
He works in construction, teaches skiing for AVSC, plays music, and of course, builds guitars. He was even building skis for a while. Sometimes, after working one job for an entire day, he has to force himself to start another full workday building instruments. His business, though, is something that's too important for him to give up.
It's something that I am nurturing and trying to make succeed and having success with. So just saying I can't do it at the end of the day doesn't work for me because it doesn't live up to everything that I've already put into it.
One of the best moments of his guitar building career happened a few years ago. He had previously met a member of the band Thievery Corporation. One day, Phillips got a call.
The gentleman contracted me to build a bass. He asked me to drive down to Red Rocks and deliver it to him backstage.
But getting to the venue was no easy task. He had car troubles, so he had to convince a friend to drive him down. Then, when Phillips got to the venue, the security guard didn't believe that he had built this instrument. It took some convincing to prove that he wasn't joking.
After I got the bass player on the phone, the guy had kind of, you know, realized I wasn't messing around. Drove up, parked next to the tour buses.
And brought the bass backstage. Once he was there, the instrument finally made it into the hands of its musician. He took it out and inspected it.
And then he put it back in the case and said, "All right, guys, follow me."
Phillips has a business partner that helps him in the shop. He plans to up his production to 30 instruments next year. Phillips says that buying an instrument he makes is making a purchase for quality over quantity. He doesn't own any brand name guitars. Everything he plays, he built. Phillips was born here. His parents have been helping him along the way, and he says that he's grateful for the opportunities he's had.
You know, family's everything, and also working for your worth is everything to me too, you know? And I've been super fortunate in the fact that I didn't have to think twice about this profession, and I had help the entire way.
Phillips' next big project is restoring an upright bass. You can also find him playing one of his dozen guitars.
Homeless Aspenite Michael Engfors made national headlines last fall when he won $500,000 on a scratch-off ticket. Months later, the longtime local is still using services at the Aspen Homeless Shelter, which include more than a warm place to sleep at night. Shelter Director Vince Savage talked with Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bechtesh.
Michael Engfors doesn't have a home, he doesn't have a job, he doesn't have a driver's license, and he is struggling with addiction. Dr. Vince Savage is the director of the Aspen Homeless Shelter where Engfors has been a client for the past 5 years. While Savage is well aware that Engfors hit the jackpot, he drove him to the lotto offices in Grand Junction to get the check, he does not believe cutting off the shelter's services is the right thing to do.
We know there's more going on than just our basic mission, but sometimes we need to be reminded of it. This case has reminded us of that, and I have guaranteed Michael we are not going to throw him out just because he was unfortunate enough to win the lotto.
The primary mission of the shelter is to make sure no one freezes to death at night and to provide meals through the day center. A second aspect is helping shelter visitors address the issues that got them there in the first place. For that reason, they do not screen the financials of those who turn to them for help.
His case is reflective of a lot of people that we deal with in that we are there to help support them in terms of self-concept, sociability, job hunting skills, and just like anybody else trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life.
Savage knows eyebrows may be raised when someone with a $300,000 savings account sits down for a free meal. But if it was anybody else who won, would they be expected to stop hanging out with their friends and family? Engfors moved to Aspen in 1963 as a child. Is it really fair to tell him to leave the valley and go buy a house somewhere more affordable?
It seems a little ridiculous to us to prohibit him from coming in and socializing with his buddies and, you know, basically being with the people that he considers family, in a sense.
Savage says the financial cost of INC4's off-and-on presence at the shelter and the day center is negligible. The shelter is not operating at capacity, and rolling out an additional mat on the church floor doesn't cost anything. The food served at the day center is donated, and there is always room for one more. INC4's had been spending money on a weekly rate at the Aspinalt Lodge in Basalt, but Savage says it's better for INC4's health and for the greater mission of the shelter for him to continue using the organization's services.
He's trying to work on some things. He's trying to stay sober. He's trying to maintain some social contact. You know, the idea of sitting in a low hotel room with a bottle is not a real good combination.
Savage says the breathalyzers used by the shelter help INC4's maintain his sobriety, and that his eventual goal is to reconnect with his estranged daughter in New York. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Patrick Fort. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Kathy Ritter was appointed as the director of the Colorado Tourism Office in December. Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bektesh caught Ritter when she was in Aspen to find out what the new leadership means for the Roaring Fork Valley.
I learn something everywhere I go, and I'm learning about the problems that people are facing, the opportunities they're seeing. One of the very common things I'm hearing is a concern about transportation issues across the state. But the other common theme is just this deep understanding of how interconnected Colorado tourism entities are and how there really is an appreciation for the fact that a rising tide lifts all boats.
To localize that, you're saying that it's not bad for Aspen that Vail exists.
Exactly, because the fact that Aspen and Vail and Breckenridge and many other places exist in Colorado means that we are seen as a premier ski destination, and that helps everybody, including the state.
What other industries besides snow sports does Colorado have that you want to highlight to the rest of the world?
Mm-hmm. Skiing is the main event in winter, but year-round, the main reasons that people visit Colorado really haven't changed much over the years. It is experiencing the outdoors, and that comes in the form of traveling the scenic byways, experiencing the state and national parks, hiking and backpacking. Those are the main reasons year in, year out, why people come here.
Does that mean that you do work with the Department of Transportation or even environmental movements to make sure that our outdoors are preserved, since that's one of our great draws?
Mm-hmm. There's kind of a twofold thrust of our office, the Colorado Office of Tourism. The main thrust is promoting tourism across this country and internationally, but it's also about removing challenges like transportation. You know, we play a role in carrying that message forward, but cooperating with state agencies that are trying to reduce the bureaucracy in getting a permit to use a national service, a national park space, or making sure federal officials are hearing our message about the need to keep trails open and in good and well-maintained.
Well, let's talk about another thing that Colorado has to offer that most states don't, which is legal marijuana. How much do you bring that into your campaigning? It definitely brings people in, but it's controversial.
I can tell you exactly how much we're bringing that into the campaign, which is not at all. We are actually federally prohibited from advertising marijuana outside the borders of this state. You know, there are many reasons why a state program would not promote marijuana, but including the fact that it's illegal. But the main reason is that it's not a main driver to our state.
I'm taken aback by that. Do you know if that's all demographics? People aren't coming just to smoke pot.
Yeah, I can point most recently to our summer research. Only 8% of our travelers actually visited a marijuana dispensary. And of that 8%, about 80% said that it was extremely motivating to them to be able to visit that dispensary. But again, that's a very small portion of our travelers.
You oversee the entire state, which, you know, does go from plains to peaks. Mm-hmm. And so you have a lot to boast about, but also a lot to prioritize. The other thing that I'm noticing is the local movement is really big. When people go somewhere, they don't want to eat at a fast food restaurant or a chain. They want to find that cute little craft beer place. Are you somehow going to help out with the small individual businesses? Is your eye too big on the whole state?
Actually, Allison, you're hitting on a really important aspect of the tourism promotion program in Colorado, and that's the Heritage Agritourism Program. And the whole focus of that program is identifying and promoting and developing those truly authentic Colorado experiences, which are just growing in fascination, not only for people across the country, but for our international markets. People in other countries want to come to the state and experience a real taste of Colorado.
Okay, well, again, Kathy Ritter is the director of the Colorado Tourism Office, new beginning in December. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Allison. It was a pleasure to be here.
Traffic signals in the El Jebel area have gotten a lot of criticism in recent months, and CDOT has been trying to improve them by tweaking how long a green light will last. A developer is proposing an unusual fix for one of them before Eagle County commissioners review a subdivision proposal next month.
So Highway 82 westbound has turned green along with, for both the through lanes and the left turn lanes. There was traffic in the left turn lane.
David Oldham is standing at one of the intersections in El Jebel, explaining how long the lights are supposed to last and why they cannot communicate with each other to smooth the flow of traffic.
This corridor is not in any coordination because the signals are not spaced properly. If they were put in a little closer to each other, it'd be more practical.
Oldham handles traffic operations for CDOT along this stretch of Highway 82. To make at least some improvements, CDOT engineers have been tweaking these lights individually. Congestion in this area has garnered lots of complaints and prompted a Mid-Valley Planning Board to vote against two development applications.
We've done a lot of research into traffic.
Keith Ellers is a representative for one of those two proposals, a development called the Fields Subdivision. He's based in Grand Junction but grew up in the Roaring Fork Valley. The project's biggest hurdle is the south side of where El Jebel Road meets Highway 82.
We know this intersection. We've all been some of those that thank goodness the windows are rolled up because the things we're saying may not be appropriate as we sit in these traffic conditions.
Ellers says the Fields Development Group paid for a new review of the traffic there. Engineers with SGM and Glenwood Springs found that intersection no longer meets state requirements for cars getting ready to cross or turn onto 82. And also according to the analysis,
the intersection itself underneath the stoplights will work for up to the next 5 years. And then it drops below the CDOT thresholds.
CDOT doesn't agree that the intersection won't be safe because of more traffic in that amount of time, but representatives do say the intersection is struggling now and may have 10 years before it needs to be overhauled. The agency in Eagle County have a rough design of what it could look like to improve the intersection, but it's estimated to cost millions of dollars. Any new development in that area automatically triggers that big fix, like the Fields.
Price tag of $3.5 million. It's quite challenging.
Again, Keith Ellers. He says, flat out, project executives can't afford that dollar amount. The Field subdivision is supposed to have 98 homes considered attainable for the middle class or technically affordable housing. 25% would be deed restricted and the remaining priced at $400,000 to $600,000. Ellers maintains paying millions of dollars to fix the intersection would drive up those prices.
If we were proposing 100 lots, for easy numbers, all right? And you had a $3.5 million cost, you just added $35,000 to the lots before you do anything else.
And but if why not eat them though? Why pass them on to the homeowners?
Well, there isn't that much margin, especially on a per lot basis. If we were selling each lot $2 million and we've got this great extravagant home and it's just gonna be wonderful, there's more margins than that.
So the Fields proposal has changed to include the following fix. Throw down $800,000 to $900,000 and do the first phase of the proposed plan for the south side of the El Jebel intersection. But that's going to be a hard sell for Eagle County commissioners in mid-March when they review the entire development proposal. Besides local officials recommending against the overall building plan because of traffic concerns, county planners say having all the money for that full fix is the only way commissioners should approve it. Plus, there's this factor. Dan Rusin handles the kinds of CDOT permits the field needs to build those nearly 100 homes. He says a 15-year fix doesn't cut it.
Our access decisions are based on state law and state regulations. And the state regulation says it has to work for 20 years.
Rusin says the best approach would be for the Fields Development Group to rally RAFTA, the Crown Mountain Park and Recreation District, and others to help raise the full amount to redo the whole south side of the intersection. The development proposal goes before Eagle County Commissioners on March 15th. The 2016 edition of the Aspen Laugh Festival comes to the Wheeler Opera House this week. The lineup includes comedians like Heather McDonald and Pete Holmes. Patrick took a look at how the lineup has a broad appeal.
What do Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Rachel Dratch, Dan Aykroyd, Horatio Sanz, and Jason Sudeikis have in common?
And live from New York!
Live from New York, it's Saturday night. You ruined it, man.
If you said they've all been Saturday Night Live cast members, you're correct. But even before that, they were part of the Second City Improv Group.
You have been listening to an excerpt of the Polynesian Banana Dance. And this is WBEZ Chicago.
In this scene from the 90s, Tina Fey plays an NPR host interviewing an author about her book about bananas. The fruit-based topic was chosen just seconds before by the audience.
With me in the studio is Dr. Sasha Miller.
The Chicago-based Second City Improv Group has put out other big names like Steve Carell, Stephen Colbert, Tim Meadows, and Keegan-Michael Key. Second City is just one of many comedy acts on the Laugh Fest lineup. Gilbert Gottfried, Pete Holmes, Heather McDonald.
Yeah, I wanted a little bit of something for everyone.
Wheeler Executive Director Jenna Bueller says the key to picking comedians is to make sure it's by committee. Bueller picked one of her current favorite funny people.
Until one fateful day, you see a girl wearing a Heartbreakers t-shirt, you rush up to her and you're like, hey, where's Tom Petty from? And she tells you, Florida. And a wave of endorphins and pleasure and meaning would wash over you.
Some of Pete Holmes' stuff about Facebook and social media cracks me up.
Steve Byrne and Heather McDonald round out the Aspen Laugh Festival lineup. McDonald is the only solo female performer in the group. Bueller says part of her goal this year was making sure comedians were on board with community engagement. You might see one of them downtown.
Because it's really important that they understand that they're coming in for a festival. And for a lot of comedians, a festival is an exciting sort of element because it's not just them on stage and one performance and sort of the one and done element.
The full performances start tomorrow with the Second City Improv Group. Pete Holmes and Steve Byrne perform on Saturday to close out the festival.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Patrick Fort. To hear this show again or download a Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.